This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I'd like to introduce Paul first as the chair. Paul Diamond is going to come in, and then each of the panel members will introduce themselves. Paul Diamond.
Tēnā tātou. Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to this panel discussion on queer history. Just before we hand over to the three speakers, just to give you an idea of the brief that they've been given about what to cover in the session today, three questions that they're going to be addressing. What do they see as significant areas for those working in queer history to look at, including community researchers as well as people working in academia? Secondly, what interesting or unexpected sources have they used in their work or their activism? And then lastly, what material from LGBTIQ activities and lives today would they want to see preserved for the future in repositories like Lagans and the Turnbull Library and other places? So, as Jack said, they'll all be introducing themselves, but this is the speaking order. First will be Tony Simpson, then Linda Evans, and then Cassie Hartendorp. And then there'll be questions, as Jack said, after all of them have spoken. So we're handing over, first of all, to Tony Simpson. Please join me in welcoming Tony.
Well, kia ora tātou, and hello, and I'm glad you could come along today. I'm a social historian and the author of 16 books, but I was also, for my sins, 10 years the chair of Rainbow Wellington, which I see has a very comprehensive display here today, and I'm pleased to see it. So, of course, that means that I'm a queer man. The German writer and critic Walter Benjamin observes in one of his essays that what we have in history is not the past, but the study of the present, illuminated by the past. And he goes on to remark that what we have of that history, furthermore, is not only not the past in full, but what he calls its fugitive remains. So where we begin our illumination depends on what we have retained as fuel to light the way. Sometimes the potential for that illumination is quite deliberately and purposively snuffed out. I'm always reminded in this context of the story of the Englishman who was conducting a walking tour of Ireland and who lost his way. So he called in at a cottage nearby and asked the resident Irishman which way he should go to get to Dublin, to which the Irishman replied that if he was setting out for Dublin, this was the wrong place to start. Sometimes we deny ourselves an understanding of our present by refusing to begin our journey at certain points in the past. We simply don't go there. And if we try to, there are plenty of people to block out our way and to suggest that there's an officially sanctioned other path that we should be travelling instead. That's a truth that applies to many areas of our journey in history. When I was a boy growing up, we had it almost literally drummed into us that New Zealand was, in the favoured phrase, the most successful multiracial society in the world. It wasn't until I was an adult that I discovered that some of the people who lived here, let's call them Maori for the sake of argument, didn't necessarily share that view. Similarly, with the notion that we were an open and egalitarian society in which everyone gets a fair go. You can make a case for that, of course. Although you might find people who don't agree with you. Again, some Maori people, or quite a few women, past and present, who would also feel that this was not necessarily a fair go society and had not been in the past. Not to mention, of course, the lesbian, gay and trans communities. In fact, let's especially not mention, when we're talking about our history in the past, the lesbian, gay and trans communities. In the same breath, as we talk about our history. Until I became an adult, I also had absolutely no idea that two people I admired tremendously, the writer Frank Sargeson and the painter Toss Woolston, were both gay, although they were muted about it because you could go to jail in those times for simply being yourself. And Sargeson, as some of you may know, very nearly did when he was dobbed in by a sexual partner who was under pressure from the police. So much for the fair go society. I found that out myself the hard way when I went to work for Radio New Zealand in the late 60s and early 70s. It's called the NZBC in those days. And I was one of those people pioneering the use of oral history techniques to make historically based documentary programs, something which later turned into the Spectrum series. I made two almost immediate and important discoveries. The first was that there were certain taboo subjects in the past that you were not allowed to explore. I made the mistake, for instance, of producing a program about the shooting in extremely questionable circumstances of 50 Japanese prisoners of war at Featherston in 1943, which most New Zealanders still don't know about, by the way. It is not the sole topic of conversation in the bars in which I drink. But the second was even more important and much more positive. There are many people out there who have never formally studied history in their lives, but who nevertheless have a very clear idea of the pattern etched by those lives on the broader community and the meanings that imparts, not only to themselves, but in a curious reciprocal relationship to the society in which they live. Often those meanings have very little or even nothing to do with the official meanings and identities that we impute to ourselves. But to find out what those unofficial meanings might be, you have to conduct a search and a rescue operation. That's why Lagans is a very important resource for historians. Now, some of you may be aware I'm currently engaged in an exercise in exploring the nature of the gay male culture of resistance, which existed prior to 1986, and the decriminalisation of homosexual acts between consenting adults. I know quite a lot about it, of course, from personal experience. Obviously, although I was in the closet for most of it, which in itself is part of that culture of defiance and resistance. But because it's no longer required, it's fading from sight and recollection. Cultures do if they don't serve a purpose. I'm interested in ensuring that it's nevertheless preserved by recording the recollections of those who were its participants. It's beginning to develop, of course, a degree of urgency because when I compiled my oral history of the Depression of the 30s, the Sugarbag Years, published in 1974, when I was working on it, there were plenty of people still around who experienced it and I could draw on them, but within a decade, many of them had actually died. They were no longer available, and it would be impossible to write that same book today. There's almost nobody around who remembers, certainly as an adult, the Depression of the 30s. We need to watch out that the same thing doesn't happen regarding the gay culture of the pre-1986 era. As Benjamin's colleague Theodor Adorno once said, in history, we listen to the voices of the dead. But a precondition of that is we have to make sure those voices are available before we can do so. And that, I hope, answers the third of the questions I was asked to address, namely, what material from LGBTIQ activities and lives today would I want to see preserved for the future? We need to ensure that we have the directly recollected and recorded documentation of that experience through the Oral History Archive here at the Turnbull Library and in other places. How did it feel? We need to have a record of to be a breathing, living gay man in an era of gay suppression. But my project goes beyond that because culture and history are not static things. They are processes. And I'm also recording both the point of transition itself, but to say how the law change came about and what role people played in that and what that has meant for existing gay lives. And equally important, of course, what it means for the lives of those gay men who have grown up in a society in which the law is permissive rather than oppressive. Has it in fact made any difference? Or have both the oppression and the culture of resistance simply reinvented themselves in new forms, as often happens in processes of social and cultural change? Well, that leaves me no time to address the other two questions I was asked to address, but I'm sure others will readily fill that gap.
Kia ora koutou. some of you may have seen Anita Brady's name advertised as being on the panel. Unfortunately, she's sick today. So hopefully at one of our other LAGANS events we can hear from her, because I think her research into same-sex kissing in public is pretty fantastic, and it'll be great to hear more about it when she's well. I also wanted to just say quickly, acknowledge, talking about queer history in the making, four people who've died in the last little over a year who've really contributed to queer history in this country. Pauline Simmons, very strong in the Wellington area in lots of community events and in law reform and lesbian organisations. Pat Rosier, probably better known in Auckland, but really influential. Vern Keller, who was the librarian at the AIDS Foundation, huge amount of work in making information about HIV/AIDS available. And Robin Duff, who a founder of Christchurch Gay Liberation, a supporter of the archives, has contributed material and recordings. And so all the absence of all of them is really important to note. I agree with a lot of what Tony said, and I really like the fugitive remains, the quote that he gave that talked about what we're using and what we're looking at as being fugitive remains, because there is that kind of thing of looking at stuff that's not necessarily on the surface, plus also the fact that things can so easily be lost and things can deteriorate, recordings can deteriorate, photos can deteriorate, so you don't have them anymore. So it's kind of fugitive in both the metaphoric and the literal senses. And I guess when I think of the themes of queer history, of the histories of all of the communities that are represented here today, it's more like how you approach it than certain particular themes. So it's full of, and many of these things are present in all kinds of history, but I think just a bit more so in our cases. It's full of complexities and contradictions. We really need to read closely to get clues, to work out what might have been going on. We need to use our imaginations as well as close research. And we need to have the courage to ask questions and to take risks to name things, and also always to think about the context. Because in a way, in all of our movements and communities, we give each other context. And so just, you know, focusing only on the personal, which has been really important and will continue to be, doesn't kind of reflect those networks and intersections and the context we can give each other. So this sort of obsession about evidence of lesbian or gay or trans identities and activities and is something that I think has really held us back, and I think we have to look with a bit more imagination and breadth at how we interpret our communities and our individual lives. The kinds of sources that have been important to me in both my activism and research have been quite varied, and that's one of the things I think that's important, to look everywhere for possible signs of it. In my case, I'm looking particularly for lesbians or same-sex women who've had same-sex relationships. Anywhere should be grist for our mill. Any kind of archive is worth looking at. And you might remember, if you came to the launch of Julie Glamuzna's book, it was almost entirely constructed from public sources. That was Mr. X, where we had the launch at the end of last year. A lot of, she read newspapers really closely, she haunted the births and deaths places, and, you know, she, all of the directories of streets, and she used public services to, public sources to the nth, and that's a good example of just being, thinking from the perspective of someone who is a lesbian, who is queer, who's gay, who's trans, who's bisexual or intersex, thinking from your perspective when you approach the sources. And one of the, just to mention one thing that I particularly love as a source, is a letter written in the early 1900s from one of the Richmond sisters to her sister Dorothy Kate Richmond, who was travelling in Europe, a companion and possible lover of Frances Hodgkins. Her sister wrote to her to let her know that she had seen at a public event Blanche with her new lady husband. Now, she wasn't very flattering about the lady husband, who's German, and she didn't have a good impression of her, but that's amazing. You know, there is evidence of identifiably women in same-sex relationships at public events in Wellington early in the 1900s. So it's just those little glimpses, you know, that you can get ideas from, expand out and kind of put together the sort of patchwork of what could have been and what might be. Thinking of the things I would really like to see happening in the researched in the future, I agree with Tony, we still haven't done enough about the cultures and communities pre gay liberation, lesbian liberation, feminism. I think that we really need to do more in-depth research in those areas here. And in particular, there's the strengths of the cultures and the imagination of the culture and the vivaciousness of those cultures, but also there are the punishments. And there's been very little research possible into the mental health so-called treatments that people received. There's not been a lot of research into what happened when men in particular were convicted, or girls and boys were put into care because of so-called inappropriate or sexual activity. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of areas still to look at, both the ones that are probably a little bit easier to surface and ones that are much harder to get at the information. The 1970s ends up getting overlooked often, and which is interesting because of the emphasis on the 80s and law reform and that. So I still think it's important to do work on that. I think it's important to look at how things are working for young people and also for old people, because, you know, there's now more and more old lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people. How is it for them? And I'm talking about, you know, as being old. What's that like? What's the experience like? How do you just get overlooked? Does everyone go back to assuming heterosexuality unless you can somehow confront that? So the whole question, I think, of one of the buttons in the display says, "How dare you assume I'm heterosexual?" You kind of need to keep that going right into the future, because that sort of heterosexual supremacy and heterosexism is still always assumed about a person unless you can prove otherwise. And how do you prove otherwise if you're not in a relationship? Well, you use our relationships to prove that often. That's an easy way. Talking about archiving from today for tomorrow, and I hope we'll have more talk from you about that, we want to make sure we have evidence and traces of all of these, our communities, our personal lives, our political lives, what we enjoyed, our cultural lives, and of course those are increasingly digital. So that is quite a challenge for us, to make sure we keep gathering the physical items, but to work out ways of gathering the digital. And that's where we need you to help us, by looking after your digital stuff. So when you take photos, when you send emails, when you write, when you set up a Facebook page or a website, finding out how to look after it in such a way that it's going to be able to be kept for the future, to be used in the same way as the newsletters and posters and so on from the past are able to be used. Ellen's going to talk a little bit more about that, but there we have some information at the library too to help people with that. But it's important to know that for your Facebook page, only you can download it. No one else can. And if you're an organisation that has a Facebook page, no one can download that. So all the stuff that's on that page can't be extracted and preserved. So, you know, it's just the issues about all the things that are the evidence of our lives now, how can we carry them into the future? Kia ora.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko te awa kairangi te awa, ko Ngāti Raukaua, ko Ngāti Pākehā ngā iwi. E whakatipu ake ahau ki te awa kairangi me whanganui hoki. Engari, nō te whanganui atara ahau, ko Cassie Harrendorp tōku ingoa. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa.
Kia ora, everyone. So my name's Cassie, and I'm yelling now, so everyone can probably hear me. And I just came to give a little bit of a kōrero from, I guess, a youngish perspective. I'm always really careful about saying the word young because everyone gets really offended when I make it clear that they might not be young anymore. So I'm not intending that. I'm just saying, you know, why I'm here. And I mean, like I got asked about this a couple of days ago, so I don't have a really big thing, but I have a really beautiful brainstorm. And if anyone wants to come and look at the brainstorm later, then by all means do so. So I guess from my perspective, when I'm coming here, I don't consider myself a historical expert, whatever that may be. And my experience comes from a few different things, and that is growing up in a place without knowing or having any access to LGBTIQ histories. It's from being mixed race and having no access to my cultural histories growing up. It's from working alongside young people and I guess their journeys around their sexuality or their gender. It's from being really opposed to oppression and to exploitation and being grounded in, I guess, political change that really challenges our status quo. So I'm talking about capitalism, and I'm talking about colonising structures that continue to enforce social hierarchies, which is still the reason why we have to keep gathering here like this. And I also have had a degree in the past, but I made a conscious decision to move away from the academy because I thought that I was really interested in making those knowledges that take place in ivory towers more accessible to people who are not able to access those. So that's kind of where my heart lies. And I guess when I was thinking about the main ideas around this, I think two things kind of stuck out for me. And one is the process of recording and gathering histories and information, and the other, I guess, is disseminating it and putting it out there and making it accessible. And while I was thinking about this, I happened to also be reading this book, An Indigenous Response to Neoliberalism. I'm such a nerd. But I was actually just reading an essay. Now I'm going to do a dramatic reading for you all. And this essay was called Cultures of Collecting, and it's by Cheryl Smith. And I actually thought it was a little bit relevant to this. So I'm just going to mention this passage kind of stuck out for me. So this writer says, collectors view the world in a particular way. Before the action of collecting begins, the person has designed the pretty, the object of desire, the resource in their minds. They have composed collections with missing pieces. They have devised the search and the seeking. Their external world becomes a hunt, a trigger of recognition that shapes and manifests their desires. In this world, Indigenous peoples live, being the collected, the named, the classified, the commons, the public domain, the protectors of the desired, the obstacles, the remnants, the fascinating, the reviled, the disappointing, the occupiers, a myriad of projections and illusions. So, thanks, Herbie. I just thought that was quite interesting that I happened to be reading that at the same time. And I guess what really stemmed from then is just thinking, I guess, about histories not as being just so contested, right? Like, I mean, that's why we're all here, because we know that actually our histories have often been excluded from, I guess, mainstream histories. That's why we have to have ligands. That's why we have to hold these events. And I guess I'm really interested in that process of how things become history, what makes a historical moment, who gets to define what that historical moment is, because actually it's always reflecting our existing power structures that are already in place. So I think that very process is, I find it very interesting. And I think some of the things that kind of sparked up, referring to my all over the place from brainstorm, I guess just really acknowledging that there are so many multiplicities, I love that word, just saying, I'm so excited to get to say it, There's so many multiplicities of experience in terms of what is class as being like in, under, around, over, beyond the rainbow. And I guess it's really cool when we're able to come together, but also knowing that, you know, where this experience, where these histories grow and develop and gather and ferment and talk and take action and speak and hear, listen, all of this kind of stuff happens in so many different places. And a lot of those aren't just photographs, or they're not just minutes from a meeting or stuff like that. So I just really wanted to acknowledge that and the hidden spaces that actually those histories are always growing. So I'm quite interested in that. And I guess also, yeah, I guess who gets to name or define what is happening? I mean, as an example, when we think about ANZ Bank ATMs, is that a historical moment? Like, many might say that. And what does it mean when our historical moments are created, manufactured, and mediated through multinational corporations? Like, what does that mean for our histories and for our communities? Kind of something that's a little bit similar, I think, is the systemic erasure and silencing of certain voices and certain histories. So has everybody heard of, like, the new Stonewall movie that's coming out or has already out? Yep, there's a few hands. And I thought it was quite interesting. See, I haven't seen it, so I'm one of those people that's just going to talk about something that I haven't seen. But many blogs on the internet tell me that apparently when it was talking about the Stonewall riots, there was a There was a white cis gay man who threw the first brick, and it's like this big moment, ooh, kind of thing. And it's just astonishing, because actually it was trans women of colour who were at the front of that riot, and it wasn't a white cis gay man who threw that first brick. But now that history has been reinterpreted and is taking on those existing power structures once again. And now us young people are being given a picture that I don't think is really true to what really happened, and I think it's really erasing. So I think that's kind of another example of, yeah, just why we have to be quite mindful of how we're collecting and representing those histories. It's not a neutral process, as we all know. And the other thing I think there is knowing that we have, I guess it's one thing that I find really difficult and frustrating, is kind of like being in marginalised groups and really feeling like you have to be the nice or respectable or polite queer all of the time. And it's like, oh, we got to do that because that's how we're going to get, you know, change or whatever. But also, I really don't want change if it doesn't acknowledge, like, the messiness and the complexity and the monstrosity and all of those really sometimes deep, dark, unsettling parts of who we are. And I think sometimes there's this move to gloss over those and just act like, you know, we're all just kind of like waiting for a nice piece of our pie or scraps at the bottom of the table. But I think we can be more complex than that and not have to silence ourselves and paint a picture that doesn't really exist. In terms of what I like, also, I just really want to acknowledge that in terms of histories and where they're being held as well. So, I mean, really thinking about how we can make some of these things accessible. I was talking to a friend last night, particularly about the role that social media has played within a lot of our younger ones kind of coming to make meaning of ourselves and of others and of our queerness or our sexuality, and how social media is kind of seen as like the devil most of the time. But actually, the first people that I came out to were miles and miles away on the other side of the world, because they were the only people I felt I could talk to. And knowing that we have some really richness in our histories there, and how do we make those histories continually accessible? I'm really thankful for spaces like Te Whanawhana, because actually being able to come together intergenerationally and learn from each other is just a process that I think is absolutely necessary. So I'm thankful for that. And I think a lot of like Indigenous knowledges and Indigenous practice totally gets that. In terms of future stuff, I don't have all the answers in terms of being like, this is what we should collect and now we should do this, because, yeah, I don't have all the answers to that. But I do know, I do want to speak to a couple of projects that are being worked on. So one thing that there's, it's actually a bit of a self-promo, but for example, Books Oceania here at the back, I mean, one of the things that we're thinking about is making sure that we are creating spaces for Indigenous and queer people of colour and who are young, but also it's open to anyone. It's actually not just about young people, because we know this stuff needs to be intergenerational. And I'm just going to quote some of those, the three, like our kaupapa. Sorry if I'm going over time, Jack. I won't be too much longer, I promise. I was like, I've just got a couple of thoughts, Negmana. So the first is boosting voices and visibility for our Oceanians living and loving under, over and beyond the rainbow. Navigate ancestral knowledges to activate and support decolonisation, gender and sexuality work that imagines and creates futures inclusive of MVP, FAFF, LGBTIQ plus peoples and their families. And I think that's like a really... like, that's a real historical process that is going on here in this kaupapa. And a couple of things that we're working on is creating a website that is a space where people can share their stories and come together and speak from that position of being Indigenous or queer people of colour. And also working on building a little community library as well, which is about just gathering resources that are really important and heart-filling to our communities so that they can physically be there and have access to those. So really interested in how we collect, how we, how, what our histories are, and also how we make those relevant and accessible to our younger generation. So thank you.
Well, kia ora koutou for those addresses. Now, there's a wee bit of time for questions. Does anyone have questions? While you're... Alan's got a question.
It's not so much a question as more, who's collecting digital in town? If we're not collecting our own digital materials, nobody else is going to do it for us. I'm going to talk this afternoon about my 20-year archive of the Lesbian Wellington website, and yes, I've already collected and saved most of the files, thousands of web pages. But who else is doing it? I've started a little archive of Lilac Lesbian Library photos, digital. And I'm feeling my way on what is the best practice, and can other people who are interested in collecting digital or doing it, perhaps we can get together and have a little focus, dare I say, a focus group, a social focus group, at working out best practices and talking to LAGANs about how we're going to get the stuff into LAGANs. Are there others who are interesting? Come and talk to me down at the Lilac stall later, or come to my talks this afternoon.
Kia ora. Thanks, Alan. One sort of digital resource I was going to mention was the incredible archive, I guess I'd call it, a digital archive that Gareth Watkins has put together. Gareth can give you the exact name, pridenewzealand.com, collection of interviews, which is remarkable because many of them have been transcribed, and it's a really good, Gareth's done a great job of getting the material out there and making it accessible, and lots of people here have been interviewed for that. And if you want to know more about queer history and things, that's a really good place to look. One thing it occurred to me to ask was to pick up on this idea of defiance and resistance that was mentioned by Tony and actually all three of the speakers. How does activism work in this sort of age of integration if there is this kind of freedom to just hang out at the garden centre like everyone else on a Saturday morning if you're not at the National Library? But how does that activism work, and where are those sort of sites of resistance and pushback at the times when you need to do that? So just wanted to ask you three, I mean, how does activism work, and where are the sites where it might be happening? Is it the queer groups at university, or is it in hotbeds of activism like LAGANs, or where can it happen in this time of integration and freedom?
It can happen anywhere, of course. I mean, quite a lot of work is done, for example, by Rainbow Wellington, which, although it's a Wellington-based collective, does a lot of national work in respect of human rights, civil rights, individual problems of one sort or another. I see that they're picked up and are pressing the campaign about blood, for example, at present. And a lot of people are completely unaware that if you are gay, you can't give blood. except under very restricted circumstances, that for many years might as well not have been there because it meant you couldn't give blood at all. So you can pick it up anywhere and run with it. But you also have to be aware, it seems to me, of the other side of the coin, because I heard somebody mention the ANZ and their loud public commitment to pro-gay and lesbian human rights policies in the workplace. And I always laugh when I encounter that, because less than 2 years ago I had to take a case to the Human Rights Commission on behalf of an employee of the ANZ Bank, because they would not stop his fellow employees from treating him badly and discriminating against him in the workplace because he was gay. So if you tangle yourself up with multinational capitalist institutions and think that you're going to get your gay or lesbian rights there, then I suggest to you there are better places to pursue that.
I think sometimes it is, you're right, Paul, it is kind of hard to recognise where activism is happening when, you know, there are big social changes afoot in the way the whole society operates, and when some huge technological change, like the whole, you know, ways of communicating really affect how you organise people and how you make that feeling of collectivity. And also when we've had this kind of society that's been totally promoting of the individual and not at all promoting of the collective and collective action and people recognising what they share with other people as well as, you know, what divides them. I mean, I think in some ways it still happens in similar ways. Like as Tony says, there's kind of civil rights and problems at work to be active on. There's the bigger picture of confronting the fact that it's still basically a heterosexist society and doesn't look at how, you know, racism and classism are interwoven with that. And so that's kind of like something where you have to take the initiative and work out a way to do it. And then I think the other part of activism is, you know, creating our sort of community life, enjoying ourselves. You know, we've got to have that as well, because doing the political activism is really engaging and stimulating, but it's also really important to connect with each other.
Kia ora, awesome question. I think about activism a lot. Doesn't mean I have something coherent to say on it, but I think, yeah, I mean, the thing is that I truly believe that resistance is always happening, however small that it may be, even if it comes out in kind of larger moments every now and then, and that I think as LGBTIQ people, I think that a lot of us really understand the interconnectedness of our struggles as well. So, you know, I think there's a lot of spaces where I've seen, you know, our communities that are out on the front and being really ready to be able to talk about stuff, even if it's not specifically about our LGBTIQ-ness. So I think that's really awesome. In terms of where activism happens, I mean, yeah, I talk about what you said about the collective versus the individual and how it is really difficult in our political environment to be able to conceive of really like collective organising that is really effective. I mean, one of the biggest marches that I've been on was around the hikoi against land, the sale of assets two to three years ago, and John Key just kind of didn't even bat an eyelid about it. Do you know what I mean? And so I guess I'm really interested in ways that we can make sure that we keep envisioning what a collective fight back looks like, but tailoring it to our times as well, I guess. And also I think the thing is that activism is happening all over the place all the time. I mean, I've been lucky to meet people from some really amazing queer straight alliances and feminist groups that are in our high schools and are just like, yes, we know that, you know, there are problems of the world and we're so ready to do something, but we're not quite sure about where to start. So can we get a little help? So it's kind of like there are people who really have this gut reaction to knowing that we need to, you know, fight against a lot of the stuff that we see in our society. But I think that really, that partnering up between generations is just so key. So, yeah, thank you.
Ka pai. Kia ora koutou. Unfortunately, we're out of time, But I think the panel will be around if people have got further things they want to catch up with them. Listening to them talk, I was reminded of something that Aroha Harris said at the Ngā Kupu Ora Māori Book Awards this week, and accepting an award for Tangata Whenua, a book which won the History Category Award. And she said she's inspired by that book because it shows that history writing for Māori is one of the best decolonisation devices she can think of. And I think we can take a leaf from that book as well. And so all that remains really is for me to ask you to join me in thanking these three for inspiring us about the whole process of queer history writing. Kia ora.